No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation.
No. That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can send us a question, post it in our chat box, and we'll try to answer it for you. Maria, how are you? Happy yes. Memorial Day.
Happy Memorial Day to you too, Michael. I'm well, healthy and well, and our county lifted the stay-at-home on Friday, so people are delirious.
I know. That's all I see on CNN is cops on the beach telling people to get away from each other. Hopefully this will all work out. We have a special guest tonight, Robert McCartney, who's a columnist with the Washington Post. He's a great columnist, actually. Been with the Post for many years. Part of a team that received a Pulitzer Prize for their reporting of the Virginia Tech massacre several years ago. We're excited to have him. He's just written an article about statehood and the President of the United States. So without further ado, let's bring him on. Mr. McCartney, are you with us?
I'm there, Senator.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on. You wrote an article the other day about the fact that the President of the United States has stood up and admitted that he thinks Republicans would be stupid to pass statehood for the District of Columbia because they would get two more Democratic senators, and it's really not about the Constitution, and it's really not about the Founding Fathers, and it's really not about any of this other nonsense. It's about partisan politics. But isn't it something we've known for a very long time?
Well, yeah, sure, we've known it, but you've never had a sitting Republican president admit it on the record out loud. Trump spilled the beans, if you will. He was talking in an interview with the New York Post, and he just said openly that it'll never happen. I mean, his view is it'll never happen. I don't believe that. But he says it'll never happen that the district will get statehood because the Republicans don't want to see the Democrats. You know, the district, of course, is heavily Democratic, and the Republicans don't want to see the Democrats get two extra Senate seats and at least one congressman, and that's the reason for it, and that they'd be very, very stupid. The Republicans would be very, very stupid to let that happen, Trump said. And as you noted, in the past, usually, the Republicans don't admit that. I mean, it's very, very rare, and certainly never to hear it at this level, for anyone to acknowledge that. They say, oh, it's because the Constitution says this, and it would violate the desires of the Founding Fathers, and they dress it all up in this, you know, idealistic, abstract, legalistic claptrap. And in fact, the reality is they just don't want to see two more seats that would likely go to the Democrats in the Senate. And the reason this is outrageous is that, a jurisdiction with 700,000 people, more people than Wyoming or Vermont, doesn't have any representation in Congress, even though people pay federal taxes and should have voting rights. It's taxation without representation, which is in total violation of what the Founding Fathers stood for.
Well, you know, it's true that other people have hinted around about it. John Kasich said to the Post, actually, to our Mayo in an interview, that he didn't want more Democrats. Jack Kemp, actually, who worked on the D.C. Voting Rights Act, always used to say that as well. He'd say, you know, I'm for the D.C. Voting Rights Act because I'm okay with giving you a vote in the House, but I don't want your guys in the Senate. But you're right. It's the first time somebody of this caliber has said that, and it really is stunning that it looks like the president has stumbled across the truth here and actually let the cat out of the bag.
This is an example of what is often described as a classic Washington gaffe, which is where you say the truth that you're not supposed to. That's what a gaffe is that everybody knows it's true, but you're not supposed to admit it. Well, he admitted it. You know, Kasich said it when he was running for the nomination. I mean, he was sitting in the Oval Office. It was an Oval Office interview where he said this to the New York Post.
Right.
So
no,
I think it. from now on, the Democrats can say, look, we know, whenever the Republicans bring up these constitutional arguments, the Democrats can say, you know, we know that's baloney because Trump admitted the truth to the New York Post.
My question on statehood
obviously is what is right, what is fair, and what is ethical? And that's where I get stuck on not understanding why it isn't automatic for people to just say, yes, it's about time.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Well, it's ethical is to give people representation in Congress.
That's why I don't see it as a partisan issue. I see it as an ethical issue. It's the right thing to do, regardless of the fallout of what would happen when that happens. That's another story.
Well, let me ask you this question, Mr. McCartney, and I don't know that you can answer this, but why is it that when 1,200 African-Americans in South Carolina get disenfranchised, it gets on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, but we have 350,000 African-Americans in the District of Columbia who are consistently disenfranchised and were relegated to the metro section? Why isn't this a national issue?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, I used to be in management and was helping to make decisions about how stories got played in the Washington Post. I haven't done that for a number of years now. I'm a humble writer. But I think that the main reason for it is that it's not news. It's not new. It's been true for so long that everyone's just gotten used to it. And what happened to the people in South Carolina is something that's just happened. You know, there's just been a development, I believe, today in Florida regarding voting rights for felons, former felons. This kind of stuff is happening and churning along, and there are developments and fights and battles and court cases. And in the district, you know, it gets covered when it comes up before Congress. It gets covered when there's some movement on it. But it's been so long that this has been the case that the people in the district are without congressional representation that it's not seen as newsworthy, or at least not seen as something novel, and that's why it doesn't get the kind of attention that you might want to see.
Well, and you know what? That's after 14 years of working on this full time, that is actually the perfect answer. That's exactly. Maria, I'll tell you, just before the show started, I said that to her. I said this, our issue is like a house that's been on the market for a couple of years. You know, they tell you to take it off the market because it's not, you know, it's shop worn. It's market worn. And I agree with you 100%. Our problem is certainly market worn. But, you know, we keep on going. This is an interesting fact, and I don't think anybody talks about this, but we keep on going back to Capitol Hill to get redress from Congress, or we go into the courts. Actually, in your article, you mentioned Walter Smith talking about how this could have an impact on the way judges review what we're doing. but or our situation. But the reality of it is that every piece of legislation that's ever been before Congress in the last 42 years to give rights to District of Columbia has passed both houses of Congress. And every time we go into court, the court says the same thing, as in Adams versus Clinton, that our problem is not a legal problem, but it's actually a political problem. And evidently, you can't have something judged unconstitutional that's actually in the Constitution. So we keep on going back to court. We keep on going to Congress. We keep on winning, and then we keep on losing. Don't you think we need another strategy?
Well, I would think I haven't thought enough about that to give you a thoughtful answer, but my impression, I'm not sure what the other strategy would be, but I think that the strategy right now is that is to elect a Democratic Senate, get Democratic control of the Senate, keep Democratic control of the House, and elect a Democratic president, and then you'd have enough votes to get a bill through Congress where all you need is a majority and the president's signature in order to grant statehood, approve the bill. Now, I think you'd actually probably have to have 60 seats in the Senate,
yeah.
60 Democrats in the Senate, yeah. Because the Republicans would surely filibuster this. But I would think that that's the most realistic. Right now, as far as I see it, and you know more about this than I do, but as from where I sit and based on what I know, that's the most realistic way to go about it right now, is to basically get Democratic dominance in both chambers and the White House.
Well, here's my strategy, and I promise, Maria, I'm going to let you ask a question. But my strategy is that you look at what just happened in Alabama with this young man, Ahmaud Arbery, who was out jogging and was hunted down by these two rednecks and shot. Now, for 10 days, his family and friends were all over the sheriff's department to do something about this, to charge somebody, and nobody got charged. But when that video was released and America stood up and said, look, this sucks, something needs to be done about this, then it happened. And that's what I think we need. I think we need America to stand up and say, this is wrong. Something needs to change. And to do that, we're going to have to put some money into it. Go ahead, Maria, ask a question.
I would love to know, because I don't think, I mean, I know people know what reporters are and correspondents are and investigative reporters are, but I don't think they know what it is like on a day-to-day basis. Could you put the curtain aside and let us know what does it look like for you on a day-to-day and a weekly basis for your stories and your reporting?
Well, sure, I'm happy to talk about that. I'm not sure exactly which part of what we do you want me to talk about. I'm actually semi-retired. I took retirement at the end of the year, or at the end of last year, but I got a contract to write one column a week, which appears on Mondays. They're labeled regional memos, and they're columns about Washington area affairs. Issues affecting the metropolitan region. What I basically do is, sort of starting on Monday, I sort of try to figure out what's a topic that's going to be relevant for the following, still be relevant the following Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And then I propose that Tuesday or Wednesday to my editors. They almost always tell me to go ahead with it. Sometimes I give them a choice. I'll say I could write about any one of these three things, which would you like best? And they tell me, and then I put out a lot of calls, send out a lot of emails, send some texts, leave some phone messages to interview a bunch of people about it, review the clips, maybe look at some written reports, do a bunch of interviews, and then I usually write on Friday, and it's edited Saturday or Sunday, and it's in the paper on Monday. So that's what I do. Now, in the Metro section of the Post, you've got, you know, about maybe seven or eight editors. There's a top editor, Mike Semmel, and the deputy, Monica Norton. And then you have other, there are assignment editors beneath them who are responsible for pods of reporters who cover certain subject areas. So you have an editor who's responsible for local government, for D.C. government and politics, and Virginia state government and politics. Then you've got one who's responsible for Maryland state government and politics, and then the local counties in the area. Then you've got one who does courts and law enforcement, one who does transportation and development, one who does education. Then you've got one who handles the sort of special features. And then each of those has, you know, anywhere from 7 to 10 reporters who cover those various subject areas. And they basically, you know, it used to be that you were working towards like a 6 p.m. deadline every day for the following day's paper. Well, now it's it's deadline every minute because of the web. I mean, if something important happens, you know, you want to get it up online as quickly as possible. So they're putting up stuff and updating it all day, and then towards the end of the afternoon, they sort of figure out what's going to actually be in the paper the next day as opposed to online. But really the focus is the online coverage now, much more than what's in the print edition. And I'm happy to answer any other questions you got.
Did you notice any change? I wanted to ask about the ownership change. Was there a change in the way the business was run?
Well, there were two changes. You mean when Jeff Bezos
yes.
bought the paper from the Graham family?
Correct.
Or more accurately, the Graham family sought out Jeff Bezos and sold it to him. There were two big changes. One of them is particularly relevant to your audience, Maria. Under the Graham family, who'd owned the paper since the 30s, especially since since Don Graham, Donald Graham, took it over, I guess that would have been in the 80s. The focus of the paper was to be a great local newspaper, and which also happened to have a great reputation nationally and internationally. But his focus, his drive, was always to basically serve the Washington community, and that's the greater Washington. That includes the suburbs, of course, not just the district. And that changed when Bezos bought it. Bezos said explicitly that his goal was to develop and reach a national and international audience on the internet. And that was the main focus of the paper. And he still, to their credit, or our credit, I guess I should say, to our credit, we have not reduced the size of the local staff, the number of reporters and editors covering local news is the same now as it was when Bezos bought it. It may even be a little more, but it definitely has not been reduced. There was a huge reduction in the number of reporters and editors covering local news following the crunch we had after the 2008 recession. Mm-hmm. And it went down quite a bit then, but it hasn't gone down any further since Bezos bought it. What has changed is that the size of the newsroom has expanded quite a bit since Bezos bought it, a lot, but none of the new resources have gone to the local coverage. The new resources have gone to national coverage, investigative coverage, digital products of various kinds, video, audio, TikToks, I mean, all kinds of things like that, foreign coverage a little bit. So there's been a lot of investment in the paper, a lot of expansion of the paper. It has not been in the local coverage because that's not Bezos' vision for what the mission of the paper should be. So that's one thing. Then the other big thing that happened is we didn't have to worry about the going broke anymore. I mean, after things really were bad after the 2008 recession. We lost I don't know, the newsroom was shrank by about 40%, I would say, roughly. I'm not, don't quote me on that, but that's, it's about, it shrank a lot. It was like over 900 at one point, and it got to like,
wow,
you know, 500. But now it's back up again. It's up to like 800, I think. I'm, again, I'm not sure of these numbers, but the order of magnitude, that's correct. And at one point we were losing like, you know, we were losing tens of millions of dollars a year. So Bezos bought us, and then initially he covered our losses, so we didn't have to worry about
being sustainable
anymore. Yeah. We didn't have to worry about basically going broke and being insolvent. Mm-hmm. Plus, he invested in the newsroom so that we were able to expand a lot of things. Now we are, I mean, it's all private now. You know, we were a public corporation before. Now we're you know, Jeff Bezos's you know, personal property. I mean, you know, we're not owned by Amazon. That's a misunderstanding. Amazon does not own us. Jeff Bezos owns us. And then he also owns, you know, a huge, effectively controlling interest in Amazon. But we are owned personally by Jeff Bezos. So all the books are private. They don't have to be made public. But they tell us, and I believe them, that we are earning an operating profit, which is terrific. And then, so we've been able to expand a lot. You know, I'd say that's really those are the two biggest changes, is that he covered our losses and we didn't have to worry about going out of business. We were owned by the world's richest man. And the focus, you know, the mission of the paper shifted somewhat from local, being primarily, you know, declared interest of primarily towards local news, and now towards a national and international audience on the web.
Well, nice. Thank you for that.
And as somebody that used to work for the Democratic National Committee in the early 1980s and in late 1970s, and used to run to the bank every week to cash his check, because you didn't want to be the last guy. If you're the last guy at the bank, your check would bounce. So I feel that pain. Let me ask you about the 800-pound gorilla in the room in Washington, D.C. These days, which is the election of maybe re-election of Jack Evans, who's on the city council. You know, this is a big problem that we have in statehood. I remember that you were there, Mr. McCartney, when we testified before the Senate. I'm not sure if you were there recently when our bill was marked up in the House, but
I missed that. I read about it.
Well, our wonderful pal, Mark Meadows, who has moved on, we're all happy about that, sat there
got more power now.
Well, maybe. I don't know. But he certainly was a thorn in our side. And you know, he mentioned, you know, everybody, Kwame Brown, Michael Brown, Vincent Orange, Jack, Terry Thomas, yes, Jim Graham. So this has been a problem. I mean, since I've been
Mary
elected.
Barry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Don't forget Mary and Barry.
Oh, and Marion Barry, not even including Marion Barry. I mean,
I
you know what?
Barry, yeah.
Life is just on a curve, right? And he doesn't look that bad these days. But let me ask you, what do you think about Jack? I mean, isn't this crazy? Right now we have a situation where he could get reelected, but then there's a special election to fill his seat. And so somebody else could be elected because he's not running in a special election. And those people who are all running in the general election would be excluded. I mean, the primary would be excluded from running in the general election, and the city council was going to kick them to the curb to begin with. So, I mean, isn't this a mess?
Well, it'll be a mess if he wins. I mean, I think that's the bottom line. I mean, if Evans wins the nomination, wins his seat back, then there's going to be a lot of headaches because the council basically voted unanimously to kick him off. And they're going to be, it's going to be a, there'll be a I would guess there'll be a big fight over that, because some people are going to say, well, if they, you know, if the people in Ward 2 reelected him, then, and they want him back, it's not up to us to
say what they should want.
Well, you know they're going to say that. The city council is going to hide behind that. That's for sure. I mean, I
think some people will on the city council, but I think not everybody. I think some people on the city council will make a fuss. Now, certainly, if he gets reelected, that will be used in Congress by opponents of statehood as an example of why the district isn't capable of governing itself. But if he isn't elected, if he doesn't win, then it all goes away, basically. So it's really a question of whether or not he wins or not. That's in my view.
Well, I think you're right about that, and let's hope that doesn't happen. I along with the Attorney General and a few other people have endorsed another candidate. Because this should disqualify you from politics. You know, taking bribes or using your office to raise money, those ought to be things that sins that you can't just come back from automatically, especially 10 days later. I mean, you know, we see Harry Thomas just got reelected to another office in the district, a party office. But we've seen it time and time again. And of course, you know, we've seen Vincent Gray, who was under scrutiny for all the time he was mayor, is now on the city council. And as you mentioned, Marion Barry was the councilman for life in Ward 8 and also got reelected as mayor. So let's hope for the best, but we'll see what happens. Let me ask you, it seems ridiculous to me. We have three elected officials in the District of Columbia. I'm one of them who was elected to fight for statehood. I got more votes than the mayor did, but yet our offices aren't funded very well, and the people that we send up to Capitol Hill to lobby for us are the mayor and the chairman. And it seems silly to me to send people to Capitol Hill that have to ask the federal government every year for between $3 and $4 billion. We send these guys up there to start a fight. And that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know how you start a fight with your hat in your hand. In the case of the senators, for example, in D.C., Tennessee, California, Oregon, Minnesota, Michigan, and Alaska have all used similar offices, and every single one of them has become a state. What do you think? Do you think we should support these offices more, or are they just Kentucky colonels? That's what we used to call them in the Democratic Party. If you got appointed to a position that was more ceremonial than anything, we called you Kentucky Colonel. What do you think about that? What do you think about our offices? Should they be used more?
I'm not an expert on this, but it would seem to me that if you're trying to call attention, that would make sense to be more supportive of the office if you're trying to call attention to the injustice that you lack congressional representation. I mean, if you've got shadow officials that whom you would like to see have voting powers, then and you want to sort of call attention to it, then that might be one way to do it, is to give them more resources and give them more visibility. Now, I think that the reason the mayor is the one who goes up and testifies is because, you know, she's very well known. I mean, she's got she's the highest profile elected official in the city, and has the most public recognition and the most power, frankly. So I think that's why she's selected to go up there, and I don't think that's likely to change. But you could give more attention to the shadow positions as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, because somebody needs to start a fight up there. And, you know, we sound, every time this happens to us, Mr. McCartney, like recently, as you well know, we feel we've been cheated out of $755 million by not being treated like a state, which always seems to surprise us. You know, it never ceases to amaze me that we stand back and we say, look, the people in Congress are being mean to us. They've been mean to us for 200 years. So, but it seems to me that, you know, if we're going to get Republicans on board, and that's really what we need to do, because as you pointed out, cloture isn't going to happen. We're not going to get rid of the filibuster. We're not going to invoke the nuclear option. And we're not going to have 60 members of Congress anytime soon. So we need Republicans. And in order to get those Republicans, we're going to have to start a fight. They're not going to come. There's no way in the world, if we win both houses of Congress and take back the presidency, that there's going to be any Republican in the United States Senate that says, you know what? Let's give them two more Democrats. That'll be a good thing to do. They're going to fight harder than they've ever fought before. So my opinion, and I don't know how you feel about this, but I think that we should be in Iowa right now, where Joni Ernst is running for reelection. She's a veteran who does not support statehood. And I think we need to be putting up billboards that say, you know, with pictures of D.C. National Guardsmen who have served in Afghanistan and Iraq, and say, you know, you've got a senator that doesn't believe these people should have the same rights you do. But we
and
don't.
Try to defeat, you know, Joni Ernst.
And try to defeat Joni Ernst. Because you defeat one Joni Ernst, and you'll see a lot more Republicans fall in line. You know, because really, this is, they have no foot, they have no leg to stand on, as far as, you know, like you say, they talk about the founding fathers. Well, who gives a damn what the founding fathers had to say? They didn't want women to vote. They didn't want black people to vote. They didn't want Native Americans to vote. They didn't even want veterans from the Revolutionary War to have a say unless they were white male property owners. So do we really care what they wanted? They really have very little leg to stand on, but we don't ever push them on. We don't ever go to their home turf and fight them. And you know, and that's what happened in Selma in the 1960s, 1950s. They were in court, they were on Capitol Hill, but they were also moving in the areas that their detractors, you know, in those off protesting in areas that would bring pressure on people to support them. So I really think that's what we need to do. And we're not doing it. Last year, we gave out $200,000 in grants for statehood, and we gave out $14 million in grants for arts. I'm all about art. My mom was the head of the local theater when I grew up, the legitimate theater. And I'm all for putting money into the arts. But I think if this is a priority, and you're talking about other priorities like education, where there's $2 billion spent every year, we should be putting some money in this and getting outside the District of Columbia. What do you think of that idea?
Well, it seems to me that this year the focus ought to be, I mean, on trying to get the House to pass the statehood bill, right? I mean, the House has never approved a statehood bill, and before the COVID thing hit, we had Pelosi and Hoyer, I believe, certainly Hoyer, had promised that there would be a vote this year on statehood. So I don't know how much that's changed because of the pandemic, which has changed so much. Right. But that would be a historic accomplishment, and I would think that should be the focus right now. I mean, don't you?
Well, the only thing I would say to that is that every piece of legislation that's been up there in 42 years has passed both houses. The D.C. Voting Rights Amendment passed both houses of Congress and went out for approval and was not ratified, so we never got the two senators and representatives. And the D.C. Voting Rights Act, which would have given a vote to Eleanor Holmes Norton, passed in the House of Representatives, passed in the United States Senate, and still didn't happen.
They passed it in the Senate with a poison pill, right, on gun control.
No, they passed it first. They passed it and didn't pass it in the House. And so we assumed that they would pass it when we got it passed in the House, when we got a majority in the House. And when it went back to the Senate, because we didn't put any effort into it primarily, because we assumed it was a done deal, they put a poison pill on it. And it kills it. Yes, they in a move that shocked us all. I mean, nobody saw that coming. And they put a poison pill on it that killed it. Of course, that's how they kill a lot of our legislation, with poison pills. So, you know, it seems to me that we keep on going up there. We keep on being successful, and we know it's going to pass in the House. We have more than a number of co-sponsors than we need to pass it. I think we need 216 votes, and we have over 225 co-sponsors. So it's a done deal if it ever comes to the floor. But then
the most in California.
Most in California. Yes, God bless you. And you know, last year, Mr. McCartney, my office was the only office that talked to Republicans. We got three new co-signers. We were happy about that. We got Dianne Feinstein from California. We lobbied Menendez of New Jersey and Wyden of Oregon. They all signed on. But, you know, we were the only office. We talked to six Republicans, mayor's office, chairman's office, D.C. vote. None of these guys talked to any of the Republicans, and we need the Republicans. At least that's the way I see it. I don't know how you see it. But, yes, there is that focus on the House right now. And again, I think it gets back to your earlier comment, which was right on, this isn't news anymore, so we don't pay attention.
Well, I think it will be news when the House passes it. I mean, assuming the House takes it up and passes it, which I would expect to happen, I think that will get a fair amount of attention. I'm sure it'll make the front page of the Post. It might even make the front page of the New York Times. The thing that's going to undercut the coverage is that people are going to assume that the Senate will reject it or, more likely, won't even take it up. I think McConnell's strategy would be just not even to take it up.
Yeah.
But I think especially in an election year, if the House passed it and people said, look, you know, the Senate could flip, so the House passed it. If the Senate flips, the Senate could pass it. Biden could be president. This could happen, apart from the whole cloture issue, which is decisive. But I think it could get a fair amount of attention. I guess one question I'd ask you and Maria is, I mean, you say that you want to fight, there's not enough fight in them. Well, what kind of fight are you talking about? Are you talking about civil disobedience? You're talking about big demonstrations? What kind of thing are you promoting?
Well, first I would tell you that in a poll that DC Vote did, they showed that 80% of America doesn't understand that we don't have the same rights they do. So that's part of the fight. It's just getting out there in the states and making an issue out of this. We have a group called Iowans for D.C. Statehood, for example, and they got every presidential candidate that came through Iowa this year, every Democrat, to agree to support D.C. statehood. So we need to do more things like that. But we also need to do things like the Joni Ernst thing. You know, hold their feet to the fire and say, look, why don't you support 718,000 taxpaying American citizens. You know, make them answer the tough questions, and we don't do that. And yes, I'm talking about protests as well. As you know, you probably remember, 71 of us got elected in front of the United States Senate a few years ago. But then that's where our activism stopped. You know, we have these rallies, and 200 people show up for the rallies, Mr. McCartney, and I know 100 of them because they come to everything. You know what? I could name 100 of the people in the crowd because they're the 100 people that come to everything. We get about 200 people. So, you know, the former chief of staff to our delegate, Walter Fauntleroy, tells a story about how they tried to get, he and Fauntleroy and a bunch of people tried to get Martin Luther King's birthday made a holiday, and everybody was against it. And Stevie Wonder came out on the Capitol lawn one day and played the song that he wrote, Happy Birthday, Martin, and 200,000 people showed up. And the next day, there were co-sponsors everywhere. The legislation got passed. And that's what I think we need. I think we need 200,000 people on the lawn of the Capitol, not 200. Mm. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Try to get Stevie Wonder.
That's what I think about celebrities.
Yeah, and we do have a few, but nothing on the level of Stevie. We've had a few. My colleague has put together some commercials with some Hollywood actors. We had one named Hayden Panettiere, who was relatively popular, and she was.
I remember her. What about Dave Chappelle?
Dave Chappelle's another guy that's done commercials for us, which is very, very nice.
And he speaks so lovingly of his time in the District of Columbia. And I'm curious, Mr. McCartney, as a reporter, are you able to give your opinion about matters?
Well, that's a very good question, because I've sort of gone back and forth in my career on that. For most of my career, I was just a straight news reporter, and I covered both sides, and you make journalistic judgments about things, about what you think is most important, and sometimes, or a lot of times, people see, you know, read political bias into that and see that as political bias, but you have to try to be objective about these things, or you can't cover what's going on. Then from 2009 to 2015, I was a columnist, and I was free to express my opinions. Before that, I'd been an editor. I was the top editor of the Metro section. And then that was until from 2005 to 2009. Then from 2009 to 2016, I was a columnist, and I could express my opinions, and I was writing twice a week. Then in 2016, I went back to being a reporter. I got the title which I have now, which is senior regional correspondent. And then I'm sort of in an unusual position. I mean, I wrote a lot of news stories, but I also wrote these columns which were labeled regional memos. And in the regional memo, which were laid out differently and labeled differently, I had more leeway to sort of express a personal point of view, or at least to provide sort of some perspective and on things. And now I took retirement. I still have the same title. I got the contract to write the column once a week. And those are still called regional memos. And those sort of vary. Like, I mean, a lot of times they're just straight news stories. I mean, the one I wrote for tomorrow, which is about COVID testing and tracing capacity, that's just a straight news story. I mean, it's attributed to officials. I quote lots of public health officials in it. You know, my viewpoint isn't in there at all. But the piece I wrote on that got me on this show to talk about statehood, where I have, there I was expressing my opinion. I mean, it was very clear opinion that I was in favor of statehood, and the and it was that was clearly an opinion. And if you actually if you look on the web, they're labeled differently. The one on statehood was labeled perspective, and you can click on the word perspective on the web, and it'll tell you this is basically the author's personal opinion. In the column tomorrow, it won't be labeled that way, and you can assume it's just a news story. Then there's sort of a quality in between where sometimes I do a lot of this. I write an analysis, which is sort of, you know, you sort of make judgments about things and sort of try to interpret things. So it's a little more than, there's a little bit more of my own perspective than a straight news story, but I'm not expressing my personal opinion. Everything I say in there is based on, you know, analysis, facts, interviews, et cetera. So there's sort of, I sort of write three different kinds of things now. I do straight news, I do analysis, and then I do perspective every now and then. Not very often do I do the perspective where I'm really expressing a point of view, but I did do it on statehood last Monday.
And so is it because of your senior status that you have that luxury to
yes.
be both
frankly,
objective
yes.
and subjective? Okay.
Frankly, it is. It's a kind of a I have a privileged...
Almost emeritus, if you will.
Yeah, I'm also... Well, I am. I mean, I'm technically retired, so I'm on contract uh-huh. with the Post. But I am. I've been there 38 years. You know, I was
wow.
the top editor. Yeah, 38 years. I was the
wow.
top editor of the Metro section. I was a columnist where I was expressing my opinion. I mean, here, look. You take... So look at the Metro section, right?
Mm-hmm.
The columnists, right? Petula Dvorak, Teresa Vargas, Cortland Malloy... They're columnists. They express opinion, right? And
mm-hmm.
their articles on the web are always labeled perspective, right? The, you know, Fennett Niropil, who covers the D.C. government, right? He's a straight news reporter. His stuff is always news. Because, I guess, of, you know, I have this unique title, kind of inflated, of senior regional correspondent, and because I was a columnist, because I was a top editor, it was in management, I have more flexibility about what I write. And as long as it's always labeled, you know, what I'm doing, that's, you know, that's how we account for that.
I think
well,
that's brilliant. How great.
Yeah,
so
and let
very,
me add
I'm
to
very
that.
Lucky. Yeah, I'm very... I'm in a privileged position.
Well, I would argue that you got that position not only due to your longevity but also your talent. You're a great columnist. I read the Washington Post every day. I've been reading you for years, and I'm a big fan. So a lot of that is ability that's put you where you
well,
are.
Well, thank you. You're very nice.
And let me ask you, because we're running out of time here, is there anything that you want to talk about that we haven't discussed? Is there something about statehood or anything else that's on your mind that you want to make a comment
about?
I
mean, we should talk about a little bit about COVID.
Yeah, let's
do that. This article I wrote, I was quite interested in what I found out last week in this article I wrote for tomorrow's paper. It'll be posted online early in the morning tomorrow, Monday. Because I talked to the top public health officials in the district and the main suburbs, and they all agreed that the Washington metro region, even though we have one of the highest rates of infection in the country, that the Washington metro region will have enough you know, testing equipment and laboratory capacity and contact tracing within just a few weeks in order to contain the virus as long as the public cooperates. That the, you know, they've been delayed in being able to do this because they didn't have enough supplies. They didn't have enough test kits. They didn't have enough personal protective equipment. They didn't have enough reagents. They hadn't hired the contact tracers. But that's all changed in the last few weeks, and that basically by early July, by June, basically second half of June, early July, the metro region will have enough capacity to do testing and contact tracing to contain the virus. And that's a big change, and that's a big step forward. Now, it only works if the public is willing to go forward and get tested, and then if they're told to quarantine or isolate themselves because they're sick or because they've been exposed to someone who has the virus, they have to be willing to do that. And then they have to, continue to, wash your hands and stay 6 feet away and wear masks and all that. But if all that happens, they now have the capacity, the public health authorities have the capacity to contain the virus and really, interrupt transmission of this thing and basically get to the state that we should have been at the beginning, except that the country completely blew it. I mean, we could have been in the same position as South Korea and Taiwan and contained the virus from the outset. Well, we didn't do that, but we could get to that just in a matter of weeks if the public cooperates. So I think that's a really important message to get out there. And I was pretty encouraged by what I was hearing from these public health officials.
Well, I think
it sounds
right.
Hopeful.
Yes. It's a rare bit of positive. I think it's a rare bit of positive news amid all the gloom.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yes, thank you. And let's hope that people comply, because I see people getting restless, and we all understand this, people having to get back to work and all that stuff. But let's hope that we can get all that, the information we need to do exactly that. And thanks for getting that out there. And
there was a very interesting thing that Dr. LaQuandra Nesbitt told me. She's the top D.C. health official. She said, and other people said this too, that one of the problems is in certain communities, people are they're reluctant to seek out health care. I mean, they don't really trust, the health establishment. They don't like going to the doctor. They don't like going to the hospital. They've heard that there isn't enough testing capacity, so they figure, what's the use? And just sort of getting the word out that it's available now, that you don't have to have symptoms, that in many cases it's free, that they really want people to get tested, and then if tested and if you're contacted by one of these tracers and they tell you that you need to isolate for 2 weeks, which nobody wants to do, but then you need to do that so that you don't spread the virus to more people. It's really a public education campaign now. And I do think that in the Washington area, people are more willing to comply than what we're seeing in a lot of other areas in the country. So in that sense, I'm fairly optimistic. But there's a lot of people, and especially some communities, like the poorer African-American communities, are mistrustful of the health authorities in some cases, and that's a barrier that Nesbitt and others are concerned about.
Well, thanks for that, and I agree with you.
And you heard it here first.
Yes, and you heard it here first. Thank you.
It's breaking news.
And let me just say on behalf of the show and Maria and I and all the people associated with it, we're so glad that you came on today. And we hope you'll come back and you'll enjoy a little bit of your retirement. Well, it seems to me you're working pretty hard for a retired guy.
Yeah, I'll say.
I'm working half-time. It's basically right. It's half-time, yeah.
All right.
It's good.
Well,
I'm lucky.
I hope you take up fishing or golf or some other old guy activity. And if you hit on something good, let me know because I'm pretty much retired too. But anyway, thanks again for being on our show.
Okay, my pleasure.
We hope you'll come back again sometime.
Okay, it's good to be here.
It was great to chat with you. Thank you.
And now,
America, happy Memorial Day. Maria, happy Memorial Day. I hope you have an hamburger or a hot dog on, for me.
Got ribs going.
You know, and some watermelon. But tonight we're going to leave you with a song by Lee Greenwood. This goes out to everybody that's ever worn a uniform, and whether that be for the armed services or as a nurse or a doctor or EMT or any of the people that are out there on the front lines supporting all of us. God bless you. This song goes out to you, and thank you. Maria, you have the last word.
As always, we'd like to thank our listeners for making us a part of your week. We appreciate the honor, and we know there's lots of competition out there, so thank you for your loyalty.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. I had to start again with just my children and my
Give the people their right to vote.